Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Racial segregation was deliberately created by public policy, but most of us don't learn about this history. Today's guest, Richard Rothstein, is on a mission to expose the fact that the United States has created a caste system in this country, with African Americans exploited and geographically separate by racially explicit policies here in the Bay Area and beyond. Here are just a few examples. In the late 1950s, Santa Clara's Board of Supervisors rezoned land to prevent the construction of a development that would be open to black residents. San Lorenzo was the largest wartime government-insured housing program, and it was restricted to whites. And in San Francisco, the Western Addition and Hunter's Point became black neighborhoods because blacks were barred from public housing and all other parts of the city. In Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, he argues that the government has denied and eluded culpability for this racial segregation. We see it in our cities and our towns across the country. He says it's time for us to acknowledge the government's role and begin to make amends. Richard Rothstein is Research Associate of the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley. And Richard Rothstein joins us from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad you are joining us. We've been wanting to have you on the show for a couple of months. And since your book has been out for a while and you have given a lot of talks, you've been on a lot of shows, I wonder what surprises you the most about the reaction you receive when people learn about this history?
Well, I think that people are as surprised about learning about this history as I was when I researched it. Of course, I probably knew a little bit more than most people did. Otherwise, I wouldn't have started working on this book. But even the most sophisticated people about race relations in this country accept the widely shared myth that what we have in residential segregation is something called de facto segregation, something that happened mostly by private prejudice or people's choices to live with others of the same race, or maybe because African Americans don't have enough money to live in middle class communities. And they have no idea that as I didn't before I started this research, that every metropolitan area in this country is racially segregated, not primarily because of private activities. It's not de facto segregation at all. It's the result of an explicit policy by the federal, state, and local governments to create racial boundaries in every metropolitan area that would concentrate African Americans in urban areas and suburbanize the white population into single-family homes in the suburbs. And when I describe this history, people are surprised. As I say, even the most sophisticated people didn't know it. And that's stunning because the history was once well known. The subtitle of my book is A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, because there was nothing secret about it in the mid-20th century when the government was doing this.
So why do you think that we don't learn about this in high school, for example, or college?
Well, I think we don't learn about it for the same reason that the broader educated population has wiped this from our memories. We don't do it because it's difficult to address. You know, in the mid-20th century, when we abolished segregation, racial segregation in schools and in colleges and in restaurants, on buses, even in water fountains in the South, those were relatively easy to abolish. If you prohibited segregation in water fountains or on buses or in restaurants, the next day you can drink from any water fountain or sit anywhere on a bus you choose or go to any restaurant you like. But if we try to abolish segregation in housing, the next day things wouldn't look much different. It's much more difficult to reverse. Once we establish segregation in housing, it becomes embedded. And so rather than confront the difficulty of reversing this, we've rationalized it with this myth that it all happened by accident, that we have no obligation to reverse it. The Supreme Court has said that because our residential segregation everywhere is de facto, that there's no constitutional opportunity to enact policies to reverse it. Only, the Supreme Court says, if it was established by government, are we obligated to reverse it? Is it a constitutional violation? And whatever you think of the Supreme Court's legal theory, their history is completely wrong, and their legal theory rests on a false narrative about how segregation was created.
How do you think these myths, especially the myths that like blacks don't want to live next to whites or they don't have enough money to live in the suburbs, we often hear the real estate agents steered them to different neighborhoods. How do you think those myths shape public opinion about where we are today, especially when you hear people talking about the projects or, young black men in Chicago? Talk about how those myths shape public opinion.
Well, that question, I'll try to unpack it. It requires a long answer, and it really requires understanding the history of how this happened. So I'll start with public housing. That's, as you mentioned, public housing in this country began in the mid-20th century in the New Deal during the Roosevelt administration. It was the first civilian public housing ever built, and it began as a project for working-class families, not for poor people, for people who had jobs but in the Depression had no housing. And it was mostly for whites, and the federal government built the Public Works Administration, one of the first New Deal agencies, built the first civilian public housing in this country. And everywhere in the country, it created segregated projects, even where communities were previously integrated. There were many integrated neighborhoods in the mid-20th century or early 20th century. We would be stunned if we were transported back to that period and saw how much integration, residential integration, there was, for the simple reason that working-class people didn't have automobiles to get to work, so they all had to live close enough to the factories where they worked or the other workplaces. And so if you had a factory that was had Irish immigrant workers and Italian immigrant workers and Jewish immigrant workers and African Americans, they all had to live in roughly the same neighborhoods near the factories. So Langston Hughes, the great African American poet, novelist, playwright, wrote about how he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. We don't think of Cleveland as being an integrated place. He said his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. That neighborhood where he grew up, an integrated neighborhood, it was a neighborhood where the Public Works Administration demolished housing and built two separate projects, one for whites and one for African Americans, creating segregation that previously hadn't existed and might not have existed if that hadn't been done. And this pattern was created everywhere in the country. Cambridge, Massachusetts, we think of it as being a liberal area. The area near MIT was also an integrated community, about half black, half white. The Public Works Administration demolished housing in that integrated neighborhood to build two separate projects, one for African Americans and one for whites. Well, this continued for the next 20 years. And by the early 1950s, we saw development everywhere in the country that there were large numbers of vacancies in the white projects and long waiting lists in the black projects. Eventually, the situation became so conspicuous, and this gets to your question, became so conspicuous that all the projects were opened up to African Americans, and about the same time, industry left the cities, and there were fewer and fewer jobs for the people who were living in these public housing projects. They became poorer and poorer, and then for the first time in about 1950, public housing began to be a subsidized program for people who couldn't afford private housing, and almost all black at the time, and without jobs, and the young men you're talking about, without hope, without opportunities, being concentrated in these downtown areas. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the federal government was subsidizing the movement of white families only to single-family homes in the suburbs. The Federal Housing Administration recruited mass production builders, people like Henry Dolger here in the San Francisco area, to build the Westlake development in Daly City, or you mentioned San Lorenzo a bit earlier, but still with the same Federal Housing Administration policy. A builder named David Bohannon built that. And the FHA, in order to grant the guarantees for bank loans for these developers to build giant developments, they never could have assembled the capital to build a development with tens of thousands of homes in one place on their own. The Federal Housing Administration gave them guaranteed bank loans on condition that they sell no homes to African Americans, and indeed required that the deed of every home in these developments include a clause prohibiting resale or rental to African Americans. So there were many, many other policies that the federal government followed and state and local governments followed. But these two, the Federal Housing Administration creation of the suburbs on a white-only basis and the Public Works Administration and succeeding housing agencies concentrating African Americans in central cities where they became poorer and poorer, created the metropolitan landscape that we see today. You talk about the image that we have of African Americans. Well, white families, whites generally, look at the way we've concentrated African Americans, although they don't understand that it was we who concentrated them, we the government of the country. They look at African Americans living in poverty without opportunity, and they assume that this is characteristic of African Americans rather than understanding that this is the product of an explicit government policy. Mm-hmm. There were many, many African Americans in the early 1950s, late 1940s, who could have afforded to buy those homes, the single-family homes that the governments were creating in places like Westlake and San Lorenzo or others in this area and throughout the country. Levittown is probably the best example, east of New York City and well-known. Many African Americans could have afforded to buy those homes. They were very inexpensive. They were cost about $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 at the time. That's about $100,000 in today's money, about twice national median income. Working class families of either race could have afforded to buy those homes. African Americans were prohibited from doing so, required to continue living in urban areas, renting apartments either in public housing or in private market. And the whites were subsidized. The subsidy to whites was so great that they could leave public housing, which, as I said, was not for poor people at the time. It was for working class families. They could leave public housing and move into single family homes in suburbs like Levittown or Westlake or San Lorenzo and pay less in their monthly VA and FHA mortgages and other housing costs, pay less for housing in these single family homes than they were paying for rent in public housing. Hmm. So we created this situation, and African-American neighborhoods became more and more overcrowded, as well as depressed because of lack of employment opportunities, more and more overcrowded because they were restricted in where they could move. There were no opportunities outside urban areas. As they became more overcrowded, conditions deteriorated in the communities. City services typically declined at that point, less garbage collection. They became slums, and whites looked at these communities and decided that African-Americans were slum dwellers. And therefore should be avoided. But this was all the product of government policy. This was not something that happened naturally. It was not something that happened by accident. It was not, as we commonly think, something de facto. It was a legal creation, just as the segregation of schools or the segregation of restaurants or the segregation of transportation was done by government in the 20th century.
In your book, The Color of Law, Richard, you write that it was a nationwide project of the federal government designed and implemented by its most liberal leaders.
Yes, that's true. The New Deal was liberal in the sense that it provided economic benefits both to African Americans and to whites, although on a segregated basis, that had never been provided by government before. So it's typically thought of as liberal, and in that sense it was liberal. But the New Deal, as well as the Fair Deal, Truman's administration that succeeded Roosevelt's, and certainly the Eisenhower administration, these were administrations that were run by an elite, a white Anglo-Saxon elite. You have to remember that the first Catholic even to be elected president of the United States was John F. Kennedy in 1960. This was an elite that had an assumption about racial superiority of whites that was ingrained in them. And they thought it was perfectly okay to implement these policies. In fact, as I said, they were thought of as liberal because African Americans never had housing provided for them at all prior to the New Deal. So this was, in many ways, a benefit, although it was segregated. There were many segregationists that had very influential positions in the Roosevelt administration who ensured that these policies were followed. President Roosevelt's press secretary, Steve Early, was a militant segregationist who made sure that no administration's statements ever were liberal about race relations. one of President Roosevelt's confidants was James F. Burns. He appointed him to the Supreme Court. Burns later resigned, became governor of South Carolina, and led the massive resistance to the Brown versus Board of Education decision in the 1950s. If Burns had stayed on the Supreme Court, we never would have had an unanimous decision in Brown. But he was one of President Roosevelt's closest confidants. Now, there were other exceptions. There were the president's own wife was constantly pressing him to take more liberal actions about race. Roosevelt's position was that nothing he did could be controversial that would interfere with either fighting the Depression or fighting World War II. And he was unwilling to take any steps that would create controversy. He wanted to save all of his capital for those two efforts. Doctor fighting the Depression, he called himself, and then Doctor win the war.
Today we're speaking with Richard Rothstein about his new book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Are you aware of this history? Richard has so many examples of segregated history here in the Bay Area, Santa Clara, San Lorenzo, San Francisco, Palo Alto, Berkeley, so many places in the Bay Area. Are you familiar with this history? Do you live in a segregated neighborhood? Have you seen it change over time? Has your family been subject to some of the policies that Richard is talking about today, the segregated policies and then the policies that really helped whites? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We are also going to talk about remedies to what the government has created. Richard says it's time for the government to make amends. So if you have any solutions that you've seen implemented or would like to see implemented, we would love to hear from you. You can also leave a comment on social media. Richard, you brought up the Federal Housing Administration. Key to a lot of the stories you tell is the FHA. And you write that in so many cities across the country, including Palo Alto, the FHA would not insure loans to African Americans. Can you give us a little bit of history of the FHA? I'm sure a lot of people don't know how it operates today.
Well, the Federal Housing Administration is one of the first New Deal agencies. The Public Works Administration came before it. The Federal Housing Administration was established in 1934. And its purpose was to insure mortgages for working class, lower middle class families who prior to the FHA were unable to get mortgages on an extended basis where the loans were amortized. We didn't have an amortized loan system prior to the FHA. And so families could get 20-year or 30-year, later 30-year mortgages with very small down payments that were amortized so that at the end of the mortgage there wasn't a big balloon payment that they had to make prior to the FHA. People couldn't get loans for housing for more than 5 years or so, and at the end of the 5 years they had to find a new lender. Most people are familiar with the fact that the Federal Housing Administration discriminated in individual mortgages against African Americans. We know the term, it's fairly common, called redlining. The term redlining refers to maps that were drawn by the federal government of every metropolitan area in the country, in which neighborhoods in which African Americans lived were colored red. Even neighborhoods that African Americans lived near were colored red. And the FHA typically would not make loans or not insure loans to African Americans in those neighborhoods. But what people are less familiar with, and what I was stunned about when I read about it and looked into more deeply, is the way the FHA not only insured individual mortgages for whites only, but subsidized the creation of entire subdivisions, as I described earlier, for whites only. I can give you some examples from this area that you maybe find interesting. I love to talk about authors. I mentioned Langston Hughes before. Wallace Stegner, the Pulitzer Prize-winning American novelist. He became famous later for Angle of Repose. But one of his earliest books written just before World War II called Big Rock Candy Mountain maybe during the beginning of World War II, I forget, got a lot of acclaim, and Stanford University recruited him to teach writing after the wars, just as the war ended. At the time, there was an enormous housing shortage. No housing had been built during the Depression, during the war itself. Materials were prohibited for civilian purposes. And then there were millions of returning war veterans coming back, needing housing. So there was an enormous housing shortage at the time. Wallace Stegner couldn't find housing when he moved to Palo Alto, as could many other middle-class, lower middle-class families couldn't find housing. So he joined and eventually led a cooperative of 150 families. They bought land outside Stanford University, a giant ranch. They hired an architect to design 400 homes for people like themselves. They hired a builder. And when they went up to bank to get loans, the bank went to the FHA, and the FHA refused to give a loan to authorize the construction of this development just outside Stanford on the grounds that of the 150 families, three were African American. And the FHA would not grant a loan to a cooperative that had any African American members. The cooperative tried to compromise with the FHA. They promised the FHA that they wouldn't have more African-American members than the percentage of African-Americans in the California population. The FHA refused all compromises. Eventually, the cooperative had to disband because it couldn't go ahead with its project. It sold its land to a private developer who got an FHA loan, built a development that excluded African-Americans, that included provisions, deeds that prohibited resale to African Americans or rental to African Americans. That community called Ladera exists still today. Now, I said earlier many African Americans could have afforded to live in these communities, and this was the case. So again, talking about Palo Alto, there was an enormous housing shortage in San Francisco, and anywhere that there was a white-only community at the time, and we're talking now the early 1950s, African-Americans, many of whom were working and most of whom were working, had good jobs, good working-class jobs, could afford housing at the prices then available, they were willing to pay much more than whites for similar housing because their opportunities were so much more restricted. It's just simply a question of supply and demand. The demand for housing for African Americans was so much greater relative to supply than the demand of whites. So all throughout the country, if a white family wanted to sell a home in an area near African American communities, it was to their advantage, even if they were violating the deed restrictions on their homes, it was to their advantage to sell to an African American. Well, one day a family in what we now call East Palo Alto decided to sell a home to an African American. As soon as that home was sold, real estate agents descended on the East Palo Alto area and panicked white homeowners in the area that their community was going to become a slum. As I indicated before, people looked at how the African Americans were concentrated in urban areas. They didn't understand that they'd been concentrated there by public policy, so they thought of African Americans as slum dwellers. And it was easy to scare white families that their community was going to become a slum if an African American move in. The head of the California Real Estate Board, the leading real estate agent in California, set up an office in Palo Alto along with a number of other realtors and began to panic white homeowners. This was something called blockbusting. It went on around the country. An article in a national magazine written by one of these blockbusting real estate agents bragged about how he organized burglaries in these neighborhoods in order to panic white families into thinking that their neighborhood was becoming a slum. They hired African-American women to go up and down the street wheeling baby carriages to exaggerate the extent to which the neighborhood was changing rapidly. They hired young men to drive up and down the street in convertibles blaring music. They had people calling randomly to the neighborhood on the telephone, asking for people with stereotypically African-American names. Is Johnny May there? In order to scare people. Well, eventually, whites in East Palo Alto did get scared. They moved out. As I say, they were selling their homes initially at more than they could get by selling to whites. But once this panic started, the white families sold it to the speculators, to the real estate agents, for less than their market value. And the real estate agents turned around and sold it to African Americans at more than their market value. Because African Americans were paying so much more for housing in East Palo Alto and other places like it than whites would have paid, they had to subdivide their homes in order to be able to make their housing payments. The neighborhood deteriorated. And so we have two adjoining communities, an all-white Palo Alto and an almost all-black East Palo Alto, created explicitly by government policy. Now, I want to emphasize, I say explicitly by government policy. Every realtor who engaged in this kind of blockbusting was licensed by state regulators in California, and this was true throughout the country. The National Association of Real Estate Boards had a clause in its code of ethics, which was incorporated into state licensing rules, that prohibited racial discrimination on the part of real estate agents. So anytime a real estate agent was licensed by a state licensing agency in this period, and I'm talking about throughout the 20th century up until 1968 really, anytime a real estate agent was licensed by a state licensing agency, knowing that the official code of the real estate industry that these real estate agents had to be working under required racial discrimination, the state agencies were violating the 14th Amendment when they issued those licenses. And the thing that's so tragic about this whole history is that all it would have taken was for the state of California to lift the licenses of a couple of real estate agents who engaged in these practices, and that they would have ended. Mm. The fact that it was never done, in fact, real estate agents' licenses were lifted in various parts of the country for selling a home to an African-American in a white neighborhood. It's the fact that state licensing agencies not only tolerated but encouraged and required these practices is another example of state sponsorship of segregation that we think erroneously was merely private activity but was in fact guided by state policy.
Today we're joined by Richard Rothstein, Research Associate of the Economic Policy Institute, a fellow at the Thurgood Marshall Institute of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and his new book is The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing the situation in Puerto Rico, and the role of private contractors on the island. 5 months after Hurricane Irma, why are 400,000 people still without electricity? Also this week,
this is a rebroadcast of Your Call due to some technical difficulties with Rose hosting. These shows have already been broadcast.
Working people. And then next Monday, we're putting shows together about the Migratory Bird Act of 1918. The administration is reversing an Obama-era policy that will affect
those this. Shows are archived at KLW.org. Look for Your Call.
As the feds keep cutting back, that's kind of related to today's show. And can we talk about class? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show with Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America, you can give us a call. We'll have a line open in a few minutes, 866-798.
Once again, this is a rebroadcast of an earlier show of Your Call.
Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. I grew up in New York City in Lower East Side, and I went in early 70s, we moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I don't know if people are familiar with the busing riots that happened and all the problems that were going on regarding the struggle to desegregate public schools. A lot of those problems would not have happened if these housing policies had not been instituted. I also wanted to mention that I believe Chinatown in San Francisco was created because of the same problem, that there was covenants against the Chinese ownership. And so the Chinese people had to basically form their own communities. And I also was one of the things that I have difficulty understanding is how as we are appalled at these kind of policies that happened in our history, that we continue to support covenants and the settlement of Jewish-only settlements in Palestine, and we finance that. And those are basically segregation. It's apartheid in this case, and it goes. It's completely contrary to any kind of concept of democratic principles. So those are basically my comments that I wanted to say. And unfortunately, there's a lot of democratic leaders who are appalled by segregation in the United States, but seem to accept it in Palestine.
Well, thank you, Lisa. We have full lines. We're going to take a few callers in a row, and then we'll get Richard to respond. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Patricia in Richmond. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Patricia Gump, and I'm a former realtor in the East Bay. And I just wanted to chime in on some of the redlining that occurred, like in my particular neighborhood in the Hilltop area of Richmond, which is about 15 minutes from Berkeley, California. And this is based on just 1989 when I purchased this house. I felt that I wanted to purchase Pinole, and I had the money to purchase in Pinole. It was $127,000, had a good job, over $70,000. But the realtor basically steered us towards this area. We were not that familiar. We were from Fairfield. I grew up in Napa. And, you know, I didn't know the neighborhood, but they were redlining, basically, not only for the loans part of it, because we had to come up with a ton of money to have as a down payment. It wasn't FHA or anything like that. It was just a regular conventional loan, but they still steered us. So we were like A paper. We had A credit, A money, and we could have probably bought in that time in Pinole in a higher echelon. And they steered us purposefully this way because they saw that we were black, and they took us to a black neighborhood. And at that time, Richmond was 40%. It was 40% African-American in that time. It wasn't because in the area here, it used to be white. It was a white neighborhood, and they had conducted a lot of black busting. The actual realtors that were in control of this area, I won't say their names right here on the air because they still are very active, and they've become millionaires because of it. And they would say, well, blacks are coming in, you better sell. Mm. And they profited extremely well from doing that. And then they turn around and sell the house to an African American at a higher price. And that's how the neighborhood changed through the years. Now, my parents had similar experiences when they tried to buy in St. Helena in Napa County. They were first blacks on one block in St. Helena and bought two houses there. And the way that happened, my father had to pretend he was white. He had all the money to buy it, and he had to go through an Italian person and pretend the Italian person was buying it, Bill Juni there, that owns on Main Street. And then he gave the key to my father. The people were irate when my father bought in St. Helena. And what they did to him is they took all the furniture. The deal was part, the furniture in the house was part of it, but they took all of it because they were angry that a black person had actually bought there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we live, because in St. Helena at that time, it was 1968, we were the first black family. There's only two or three black families in the whole town.
Hmm.
And so... So that is our experience, and my dad he was the only person who had the down payment for the house, but yet he was still discriminated against, even though with A paper credit and A number one, the only person with $5,000 to buy cash money.
Wow, still. That's amazing stories, Patricia. Patricia, what are your thoughts? I mean, Richard argues that the government needs to admit that these policies were so detrimental to communities across the country, and it's time to make amends. Given that your family was directly affected by these policies, what would amends look like to you?
Well, of course, you know, we've always talked about, you know, 3 acres and a mule and reparations for people who have been, you know, hurt by our government. My family, they're Cape Verdean, they're West African, right? So we were just happy to be in America trying to make it. And we thought it was an opportunity, but we also saw that. My father came to a segregated America where there was whites-only signs here. But yet we still embraced, you know, and try to assimilate into it. But we wouldn't want to sue them, or, you know, that's not the kind of people we are. We don't like handouts. But in retrospect, and also knowing how the African-American experience and assimilating and seeing institutionalized racism and seeing that the opportunities, like, are there for white people or not, and that they have white privilege that we don't have, yes, I believe in my heart that they should. They should do something.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Patricia. I mean, one of many. Richard has so many other stories that are similar to yours. And Richard, what are your thoughts? Let's bring up some solutions. You've got a lot of solutions in your book. You talk about making amends. What would you say is at the top of your list at this point?
Well, the top of my list is making people aware of this history, because in this case, and it's different from many, many other public policy issues that we deal with, our inability to address segregation rests on a flawed historical record. In many other situations, we can not understand the history and still decide to move forward. But in this case, so long as we believe that we have de facto segregation, we are not permitted by current legal doctrine to address it. So one of the first things we need to do is expand people's understanding of this history so that there will be popular understanding of the necessity of reforms and political pressure for reforms. I don't suggest that simply knowing this history is going to change anything. Every civil rights victory that we've ever had in this country required not only better knowledge but also organization. The civil rights movements engaged in civil disobedience and political pressure and marches. So all of those will be necessary. But understanding the history is part of it. In the book, in my book, The Color of Law, I describe how I reviewed all of the textbooks that are most commonly used in American high schools today to teach American history in middle schools and high schools. And every one of them lies about this history. I don't use that word lightly. They do not tell the truth about it. The most commonly used American history textbook that I examined was something called The Americans. It is 1,200 pages. In those 1,200 pages, there's one paragraph devoted to the subhead is discrimination in the North. Within that paragraph, there's one sentence on housing, and the sentence is, in the North, African Americans found themselves forced into segregated housing, with no mention of how they were forced, who did the forcing. There's all kinds of discussion in the textbook about how the Federal Housing Administration created a middle class by enabling working class families to move to single family homes, but no mention of the fact that it was done on an exclusive basis. Well, every one of your listeners lives in the school district, either has children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews or brothers and sisters who were involved in the local school system. They know the principals and the teachers and the superintendents and the school board members. And I think the first thing we can do is begin an effort to make sure that the history is taught correctly. And I guarantee you that if we make an issue of how the history is taught in schools, that will start the conversation among adults.
Mm-hmm.
Until we get that kind of understanding, and until we get the kind of organization, mobilization of a new civil rights movement to address this, we can talk about remedies, but there's not much that can be done. There are some things we can do in the short run. They're still politically unrealistic. We certainly have policies in place today that the federal government implements that reinforce segregation, although not explicitly any longer the way they did in the mid-20th century. Many of the listeners are probably aware of the Section 8 program that provides a subsidy to poor families, mostly minorities, to rent housing. But the subsidy is designed in such a way that it reinforces segregation because the subsidy is too little to rent an apartment in a middle-class neighborhood, in a non-segregated neighborhood, and it's actually too much to rent in an already segregated low-income neighborhood. So landlords in those neighborhoods take advantage of the program and exploit it and charge more than the market would otherwise require. So that program could easily be reformed to increase the subsidy for rentals in high-opportunity neighborhoods and give a priority to families who use them in high-opportunity neighborhoods. Similarly, the U.S. Treasury Department has a tax credit that it gives to developers who build housing for low-income families. That tax credit is used to reinforce segregation because developers build those projects only in or predominantly in, not only, but predominantly in already segregated low-income communities. We could very easily change the design of that tax credit so that there was a priority given to building homes for minority families, for low-income families in more integrated communities. So there are things we can do in the short run. We can abolish in the suburbs. We can abolish ordinances, zoning laws that prohibit the construction of townhouses or even single-family homes on small lot sizes that would permit minority families to move into those suburbs. That would be another thing we could address. I do describe, as you say, many of these in my book, but the focus of my book is not on remedies. The focus on my book is on understanding the necessity for them by understanding that we have not a de facto system of segregation, but a de jure system of segregation, state-sponsored segregation that's just as unconstitutional as the forms of segregation we abolished in the 20th century.
Since you brought up textbooks, Richard, I wanted to ask you about how this affects students when they don't understand or know this history. There's a professor, Sarah Scheer, who works at Penn State University, and she has looked at how schools teach or do not teach Native American history, specifically genocide. And as you can imagine, it's really bad, even here in California. It just does not go into the details, doesn't give the truth. And she said what she sees in her classrooms is that because students don't know this history, a lot of them do not understand why Ferguson happened. They don't understand why football players are kneeling. She says that there's a huge gap in their understanding, and that is why Native American history, the history that you write about in your book, is so important. Can you talk about that? I mean, you open your book writing about riots in Ferguson, Baltimore, Milwaukee, and how they captured our attention, but a lot of us don't really understand why they happened.
Well, I don't think I can say it any better than you just did. If the younger generation doesn't understand this history any better than our generations, adult generations, have understood it, and as I say, it's not just students who don't understand it, it's most of the American people don't know this history. If the younger generation doesn't understand it any better than adult generations do, they will be as poorly prepared to remedy it as adult generations have been. So I'm not suggesting that understanding is the sole requirement for reform, but it's one of them and it's a necessary one. And you asked what people can do, what we can do today. This is a very local action that people can take to try to begin the path of reform and desegregation of the society. Racial segregation, let me just say this, racial segregation of the United States, of every metropolitan area, is the underlying cause of the most serious social problems that we face in this country. Lisa began the question period by talking about busing. We shouldn't have to do busing. As she suggested, the schools today are more segregated than any time since 1970 in this country. And the reason they're more segregated is because the neighborhoods in which they're located are more segregated. The way to integrate schools is to integrate neighborhoods, so that children don't have to get on buses to go to integrated schools. That's one serious problem. You mentioned the riots in Ferguson and elsewhere. Those kinds of conflicts would not exist if we were not concentrating disadvantaged young men in neighborhoods where there are no good jobs and no opportunities, and forcing them really to operate in the underground economy, attracting the attention of the police, getting into a cycle of violence. Those problems wouldn't exist if we didn't have segregation. Mm. Even our enormous income inequality is exacerbated by racial segregation. We know, for example, that the children from a poor family who grow up in a segregated neighborhood have much less chance as adults of becoming middle class than children from families that are just as poor but who live in more integrated neighborhoods. So that problem, too, is exacerbated by racial segregation.
You have a section in your book that I think needs to be in highlights and headlines. And you write about what happened in Chicago. You write that the FHA's redlining necessitated the contract sale system for black homeowners unable to obtain conventional mortgages. And this created the conditions of neighborhood deterioration. And you write about how this resulted in gang violence. And Mark Satter was a Chicago attorney who in the early 60s represented contract buyers facing eviction. Mostly he was unsuccessful. His daughter Beryl, who's now a professor of history at Rutgers, described the conditions he encountered in her memoir, Family Properties. Can you summarize that? I think this part of your book is just so important.
Well, it's related to what I was describing before. Because African Americans were locked in to neighborhoods while their population was growing and not able to get mortgages for homes in those neighborhoods and also not able to move to less crowded neighborhoods, the conditions in those neighborhoods deteriorated. Families were required to buy homes on a contract. That means like the installment plan. They gained no equity the way we do in traditional, now traditional amortized mortgages. That meant their housing costs were much higher. As I said earlier, that required them to subdivide their homes, to take in relatives, to create an overcrowded neighborhood, which deteriorated and became a slum. And that those slum conditions were created solely because the Federal Housing Administration refused to grant loans to African Americans in African American neighborhoods and refused to permit African Americans to benefit from the suburbanization that it was subsidizing for whites. We would not have had these overcrowded neighborhoods that we still have today. We would not have those overcrowded neighborhoods if African Americans had the same legal opportunities to purchase homes in uncrowded neighborhoods that whites had. And all of this was heavily regulated by the government and supported by the government.
The section that stood out in this part of your book was about overcrowded neighborhoods, meaning overcrowded schools. And in Chicago, officials responded by double shifting the students. Children were deprived of a full day of schooling and left to fend for themselves in the after school hours. And these conditions helped fuel the rise of gangs, which in turn terrorized shop owners and residents alike.
Yes, I said that. I wrote that, and that's accurate. Schools, rather than allowing children to go to uncrowded schools nearby, which were mostly white, what the city of Chicago did, the Chicago Board of Education did, was double shift. They placed trailers. They were called Willis wagons after the then superintendent of schools in Chicago, Willis. They placed trailers on the playgrounds of existing African-American schools to ensure that they wouldn't overflow into white neighborhoods, and it created exactly the kinds of conditions that you described. Yeah. I think the key point is the one that you referred to much earlier, and that is whites' images of African-Americans were created by the deteriorated conditions in which African-Americans lived, and whites assumed, and still assume today, that these are characteristics of African Americans, not the result of government policies.
Richard, how do you deal with these opinions today at a time when, at the State of the Union, Donald Trump said, oh, the Congressional Black Caucus didn't stand when I said that unemployment for blacks has gone down? I mean, he even used the word treason. A lot of these opinions, these racist opinions that people have, are becoming stronger because of who is in the White House.
Well, I actually am quite hopeful. You may be surprised by this. But at the same time that there is a exposure of white supremacist sentiment in this country, led unfortunately by the President of the United States, there is also going on in this country today a more accurate and passionate discussion of the legacy of slavery and of Jim Crow, its effects today, than we've ever had before in American history. Mm-hmm. The attention that you're giving to books like mine, and it's, mine is not the only one, is one indication of that. Another indication is the attention that's been given to the removal of statues across the South that commemorate generals who fought to protect slavery. If your listeners do nothing else, they should go to the New York Times website and read the speech that Mayor Mitch Landrieu of New Orleans gave when he removed the statue of Robert E. Lee. It's inconceivable even 2 years ago that a white elected politician in the South could give a speech that was that honest about the legacy of slavery and how it transmits to conditions today. We have other authors, people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Nicole Hannah-Jones, who are writing about these issues. The Black Lives Matter movement is calling attention to it. So while you do, on the one hand, have the rise of white supremacy, you also have a much greater understanding, not enough certainly, but a greater understanding of the conditions that we've created to segregate African Americans and to depress their living conditions and their economic conditions. And I'm hopeful that this conversation will grow, that people become more aware of our obligations to remedy this sorry history, at the same time that I'm frightened by the rise of white supremacy. But my my hope is that the more accurate and passionate conversation among people who want to remedy this situation will prevail.
Richard Rothstein is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and author of The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. Richard, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rose.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Puerto Rico and the role of private contractors on the island. While people are getting their electricity back, 400,000 are still without, 5 months after Hurricane Irma. And the stock market is getting international headlines, but how are reporters covering how it affects working people? That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you missed any of our past shows, you can sign up for our podcast at Your Call Radio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show. Lauren Schechter is our line producer. Kevin Vince is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.